Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, dubbed the Hip Young Division of the Commonwealth Club, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. Joining me tonight is Mr. Marcos Melitzis, founder of the popular blog Daily Kos and author of American Taliban, How War, Sex, Sin, and Power Bind Jihadists and the Radical Right. Now it's our chance to meet the man behind the blog and the book. So welcome, Marcos. So, Marcos, you've been a very well-known blogger for quite some time, and this book clearly expresses a number of things that you've talked about on the blog. Can you tell us a little bit, kind of what the genesis of the book was, and what your hopes were in writing this book?
Yeah, I've spent as a progressive and as a very outspoken anti-war progressive who has been sort of on the forefront of the battle against the unitary executive and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I've been accused by Republicans, by my conservative friends, of wanting the terrorists to win. That I want Sharia law across the country. That I am somehow making common cause with the terrorists. And that was always very ludicrous to me for a number of reasons. First of all, I served my nation in uniform, and something that most of my critics can't say for themselves. They're too busy hacking on keyboards to actually wear combat boots. They're too good for that sort of thing. I wasn't. But beyond that, from an issue perspective, the fact of the matter is that the conservatives in this country, who I call the American Taliban, are basically, from an issue perspective, when we're talking about social issues, practically indistinguishable from our Islamic fundamentalist enemies. They are militant. They think violence is a solution to their problems. They are anti-democratic. Same thing. They think that when you're basically speaking the word of God and you're pushing the word of God and you're so ideologically certain as they are, there's no reason to compromise. And no method is off limits, including violence. They fetishize guns. Same issue again. They want to impose a rigid ideology, their theocracy, on the rest of us by any means necessary. They oppose the role of women in society, equality in society. They think that's a ludicrous notion. They want to keep men in a dominant position. They hate gays, have bizarre hang-ups about sex, which is the best chapter in the book, I promise you. They have bizarre hang-ups about the culture. They try to dominate the culture because they understand that culture is progressing and it's making people more tolerant and more open to different kinds of people and diversity. And they're hostile to science, knowledge, and education. Anything that violates their rigid ideology is suspect and must be defeated. Therefore, they've created their bubble where they create their own alternate reality where Barack Obama is a Kenyan socialist communist who wants to bring the second Nazi era to the United States after they put all the conservatives into government-run FEMA camps. They create these wonderful conspiracy theories, and they're able to live in this ideological bubble. So to me, that is very similar to the sort of Islamic Taliban mentality where you create your own bubble to push your own brand of hate and intolerance and use any means necessary to impose that on the rest of us.
So was there kind of a moment where you came up with this sort of big analogy of the Taliban and the religious right in America?
About 5 years ago, I started writing a series of blog posts, actually, in the Daily Kos titled The American Taliban, where I sort of went through on women's equality. You know, they're actually very similar. The use of the fetishizing of guns, they're very similar. And I just get going down the list, and it's a theme that I've sort of had on and off for the last, like I said, like last 5 years. It just took me this long to write the book because I finally, it took that long for me to get so fed up with having to answer the notion that I wanted the terrorists to win, when in fact the same reason I want the terrorists to lose is the exact same reason I want Republicans in this country to lose.
So how do you, and that is a good segue into into my next question, which is you're referring to they, and you know how they have these attitudes that are like the Taliban, and then you referred to Republicans. And one thing I found in reading the book was a certain kind of conflating of quite extreme right-wing views with much more mainstream Republican views. So how do you kind of draw the circle around, you know, kind of who's Taliban and who's loyal opposition?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you ask that question. Some of the biggest criticism about the book has come from the progressive side. People are saying, well, Ann Coulter hasn't beheaded anybody, so why could you compare her to the American or to the Islamic Taliban? And it's like, okay, I'll concede that Ann Coulter hasn't beheaded anybody, and I'm glad that's a new bar. If you haven't beheaded somebody, you're not that extreme. You behead somebody, you're extreme. I put that bar a little bit lower than that. And what the book really gets at is the mores, the values that they're pushing, because ultimately they want the same thing. They have different ways to do that because their societies allow for different creates different boundaries, legal boundaries and sociological boundaries. But the notion that Americans are better, that there's some sort of American exceptionalism, that we're not going to be as bad as the Taliban because the Taliban are monsters and Americans can't be that, I think is patently false. And you don't have to go back too far in American history to see the sort of barbarism that we as a nation have been capable of doing in the past. They used to have picnics at lynchings in the South. So the notion that, well, we wouldn't hang up anybody is ridiculous. We just had the president of the Montana Tea Party group, and you were in Montana for some time, post on his website, on his Facebook site, that he likes his fruits hung up. And so he needed to get the rule book from Wyoming to find out exactly how to best do it. Obviously speaking about Matthew Shepard's execution in Wyoming. So the notion that, oh, well, these people aren't the same. You have the Senate candidate for the Republican Party in Nevada, which is the marquee race this cycle, against Harry Reid, who's the Senate Majority Leader. Sharon Angle is a Republican. She has said that if the Republicans don't take control of the Senate, that there will need to be Second Amendment remedies to the problem. She's not talking about the right to bear arms. She's talking about use of weaponry, of guns. There is a nationwide shortage of ammunition right now that spans about 6 months. It started the day Obama was elected. There's a nationwide shortage of ammunition. They're not hoarding guns and ammo because they want to have a civil democratic debate. And there was, after Obama was elected, there was a series of violent incidences, too. Those tapered off as the Tea Party took off. It sort of gave them an outlet. And like I like to say, I'd rather that they scream about death panels than be death panels. So that's an upgrade, and that's why I think the Tea Party's not all horrible. But what happens when they don't take control of Congress this cycle, if that happens? What happens when Obama's reelected? Because they've convinced themselves that they're with the majority and that the American people are with them. So when democracy no longer works, these people have shown a propensity for violence. They definitely have the tools and the means to do it. And just because they haven't done that yet doesn't mean we can't be vigilant, because they have to some extent. The rhetoric is certainly there.
Right. Well, I can say, having lived in Montana for 8 years and observed quite a bit of the, you know, militia movements and various fringe characters there, I mean, they're not really people that I fear very much. I mean, these people are basically, you know, very out there and not really very influential. I mean, so the head of the Montana Tea Party, you know, is some, I don't actually know who he is, but I can imagine, you know.
No, he's probably
and
crazy,
he's, you know, he's some self-appointed, you know, bozo from somewhere in Montana, you know, who gets out there and makes a lot of big rhetoric. But, you know, even the militias in Montana, when there was the militia movement in the 90s, you know, they weren't really actually a threat to the state. I mean, once law enforcement decided that, you know, that they weren't going to kind of tolerate this kind of stuff, you know, they were basically exposed as a bunch of not very smart people, you know, who had a bunch of rifles in their pickups, but it didn't really go much beyond that.
Yeah, but back in the 90s, they weren't getting elected. They weren't getting nominated for Senate seats, like in Delaware and Arkansas and Colorado and so on. They were the fringe, and they were seen as a fringe. They were the John Birchards of
old. Okay, well, so that brings me back to the question I was asking, which is, how do you define, you know, what's the fringe and what's the mainstream? Because I think this is important. Your book could be read as, you know, Republicans equal Taliban. Was that your intention in the book?
I think their
Republicans equal Taliban?
Yeah, their values on social issues, absolutely. Well, because not, they do want, like I said, they're militaristic. They oppose women equality. They hate gays. I mean, they
well, do you
all
so
of that.
Would say Meg Whitman values. Fit into that category as
I'm
an
sorry?
Example? Would someone like Meg Whitman fit into that category?
Maybe. I'm looking more at very social conservatives. I mean, the millionaire, if we were talking about a Republican Party that was really fixated on their tax cuts for billionaires and millionaires, I would disagree with them, but I wouldn't compare them to the Taliban. Because a question about tax cuts or issues about, regulation of business and overregulation, we can have those debates, and those, I think, are legitimate debates, and we can have legitimate disagreements. It's when they're trying to impose their basically rigid morality and their skewed and bizarre morality on the rest of us, because people don't want that. And that's why I think a lot of times they resort to violence and violent rhetoric, because there's a frustration that the public at large doesn't buy that kind of craziness. And in the past, they were sort of fringe and sort of off in the sides, but they're no longer. I mean, when the Department of Homeland Security released a report talking about right-wing extremists, sort of conservative movement attacked the Obama administration, which didn't even commission a report. It was a Bush administration commission report, and then walked around with T-shirts saying, "I'm a right-wing extremist." Right? I don't tie myself to the leg of left-wing extremists, eco-terrorists and whatnot. Right? I don't see that as a valid way to express your opinions in a functioning democracy. Right? The right wing embrace these people, and they do so on a daily basis. Because they are taking over the Republican Party. So I see people like, say, a Christine O'Donnell. I absolutely see her as a member of the American Taliban. When she goes around and says, you know what, the Bible says a woman needs to submit to her husband and a woman doesn't need to submit to her husband, but that's not slavery because she has to gracefully submit. And see, by having it be graceful, that suddenly makes it, I don't know, kosher?
Right. Well, I think that most people would agree, even a lot of Republicans, frankly, would agree that Sharon Angle is kind of
she got the nomination. You have Rush Limbaugh, who's the sort of the prime mover of the Republican Party, enforcing a obedience to her. Karl Rove had the audacity to criticize Christine O'Donnell. The thing about Karl Rove you got to understand is that he's just spent the last three decades manipulating this American Taliban for electoral purposes. But he was more focused on tax cuts for billionaires. That was always his motivation, is to make his rich buddies richer. But he needed the ground troops, and the Christine O'Donnells of the Republican Party were great. And they would communicate with that crowd using what's called dog whistle politics. Right? So you talk about privatizing Social Security instead of destroying Social Security. Suddenly you have this American Taliban rise and take over. You have the inmates taking over the asylum, and you have Christine O'Donnell saying things that they don't want everybody to hear. So to me, a perfect example is the Republican running in Wisconsin, who just ran a campaign ad. This thing was brilliant. The Republican did. Saying, "My opponent, Russ Feingold, is accusing me of wanting to destroy Social Security. And I'm here to tell you face-to-face that he's right." Right? So you have Karl Rove going, "Shut up!" Like, we don't want people to know that. He's banging his head on his desk saying, "We've spent all this time creating this incredibly complex dog whistle vocabulary so we can communicate with you without letting regular Americans know what a real agenda is. And you're coming in and you're spilling the beans, talking about the Rand Paul in Kentucky, talking about how the Civil Rights Act is unconstitutional." He's outraged that the government would pass the Civil Rights Act. You have in the Republican in Wisconsin is so extreme, actually, that he testified against a bill that would make it easier for rape-abused children to sue their attackers, because that would create an economic catastrophe if raped children could actually get compensated. It's a video. He testified in public at a government committee. I mean, Karl Rove's going, "Shut up. Shut up, shut up, shut up." Because we don't want people to know. So, yeah, they've taken over their party. And Karl Rove criticized Christine O'Donnell. He criticized her when she was elected. And the next day, he went on Rush Limbaugh, and Rush Limbaugh basically slapped him silly to the point where Karl Rove basically had to say, "No, you're right, Rush. I absolutely think Christine O'Donnell can win, and she's great, and I support her wholeheartedly." Complete 180 degree. They cannot. The money Republicans, who are not American Taliban, are now becoming accessories to the abuses of the more radical fringe, which has taken over
that,
the GOP.
I mean, that probably remains to be seen, right? I mean, because the people that you cite, you know, all the people you cite in this conversation, a lot of people you cite on the book, in the book, they really are fringe figures. So, you know, to kind of take that as representative of all Republicans.
If you talk about the president of the Southern Baptist Leadership Council, right, you know, with 80,000 churches, you can say, well, I've never heard of that guy. He's fringe. These people are not fringe. They are key members. And they're the kind of people that are spiritual advisors to the John McCains and the Mitt Romneys and so on. So these people are tied to the Republican power structure. And as they take over their party, yeah, Christine O'Donnell's not going to win in Delaware, but Joe Miller in Alaska is probably going to win. Russ Feingold's opponent in Wisconsin, whose name for some reason it eludes me right now, he's actually up double digits in the polling. He may actually win. Russ Feingold is in serious, serious danger. You have Harry Reid, who's up against the looniest of loons, who is in serious danger of losing. It's a tied race right now. So you can't say, well, it's a bunch of fringe actors. Once upon a time, they were fringe actors. Right now, they're going to be in the Senate and in the House, and they're gradually taking over their party.
So why do you think they've gotten so much traction?
Well,
I mean, why has their message resonated in the way that it apparently has?
Why? Because a black man with the middle name Hussein won the election. I mean, that
really?
Was a trigger.
Well, Rush Limbaugh had a lot of listeners before Barack Obama
but they weren't that really worried about deficits, were they? You have a movement that's predicated on a notion of fear of the other. Same with the Islamic fundamentalists. There's a fear of the outside world, of others. And there's this notion that they're undeserving people are using their tax dollars. So they're paying taxes, and they don't realize that most of this money is coming back, especially in poor districts, poor states. This money is coming back double, twofold over, right? Unless you live in California or New York or New Jersey, you're getting more money from the federal government than you're putting in. But they don't see that. They think it's going to welfare queens in the ghetto. I mean, that's their notion. And they hate Muslims because Muslims want to impose the same thing that they want but on America, and it's a different name of the God's name is different, so suddenly that becomes a problem. So you have this fear of basically brown people and immigrants as well. So brown people, African Americans, immigrants. You have a fear of Muslims, and then you have an African American whose middle name is Hussein wins the election, and a lot of these people's head exploded. And you could see it, like in slow motion, you could see their head explode. And there were a lot of violent incidents happened after. And like I said, sort of that violent incidences were tamped down, most of them. The guy flew his plane into the IRS building in a very Al-Qaeda style, and call him a fringe or lunatic, he killed a veteran in that attack. And it was very much a politically motivated attack. So you can say, well, these people are fringe, yes, but they're armed and they're cohesive. And now they're gathering their strength, and they've so taken over the propaganda machines of the Republican Party that they have the ability to create this alternate reality, and they're using that to build recruits and build that level of outrage. And so they're convinced. I mean, 33% of Republicans think that Acorn stole the 2008 election for Obama. I mean, there's not even an argument of how Acorn could have stole it. Mickey Mouse was registered to vote. Yeah, but Mickey Mouse didn't vote.
Well, so if you, even in the book itself, you know, a lot of the examples you cite are from way before the election of Obama. So Obama's election can't explain by itself the attraction that this way of thinking has. I mean,
well, it's brought it out to the forefront. I think it's really energized them in a way that they were always out there. And I think a lot of this is based on economic inequities. And a lot of that fear comes from the fact that they sense their own economic future flying away. The American dream is less and less a reality for more and more people these days. And so it's easier to scapegoat the immigrants that are taking their jobs away, and those African Americans who are too lazy to work, who are taking my tax dollars on welfare. It's easier to scapegoat than to realize that, yeah, the world is an effed up place, and the reason it's so screwed up, it's because of these policies in place that allow for the economic inequities to grow to historic proportions. The gap between the rich and the middle class has never been bigger, and to the poor, you know, even more so. The middle class is shrinking. There are fewer opportunities, economic opportunities. This may be the first generation that is less well off than their parents. And so it's very difficult, and it is easier. The Republicans have done a fantastic job of convincing people that government isn't a solution to those growing issues of inequality. Therefore, government can focus more on irrelevant social issues than on the income gap. So I think that's rude. I mean, if we get serious about that, I don't so much get into that in my book, because the book is more about those values and how they express themselves. But if we're looking for root, I think it is. It's an income issue. And it's, I think it's no accident that militia movement sort of spring up and are fueled in times of economic distress, less so in times of economic gain.
Well, and then that goes to the question of whether the Democrats, and I would put, say, yourself in this camp, for example, I mean, perhaps there is a somehow a failure to communicate some of the things you were just talking about, right? So why is it that people would vote for things that are against their economic interest? Well, they apparently do, according to the Democratic analysis.
Well,
and they do that all the time, and they've been doing it for decades. And so why is that? You know, I mean...
Well, perfect. I mean, Republicans have convinced people that government cannot help them economically. And I think
is that just because they're better rhetoricians?
I mean, we don't have our own sort of media infrastructure that's able to push, first of all, convince people that, you know, complete lies, and second of all, push those into the traditional media. You know, Daily Kos is one of the largest progressive platforms in the country. We reach 2 million people a month, and that sounds fantastic. Wow, 2 million people. Rush Limbaugh reaches 20 million people every day. How do you compete against that? We can't. Keith Olbermann reaches about 1.5 million people, 2 million people a day. I mean, our big media people reach a fraction of the country, while you throw in Rush Limbaugh, you throw in Fox News, and they have this in the internet, the conservative internet, and they have this incredible machine. We don't have that. Now, what we had right now, the last 2 years, is we had government. We had supermajorities in Congress and a White House. This was an opportunity to show people how government could make people's lives better. And one of the big failures for Democrats in the last 2 years has been that they didn't. The healthcare bill, you know, doesn't even take effect until 2014. I mean, people basically are seeing that it costs a lot of money. They're seeing their own healthcare bills keep rising, their whole private insurance. Mine went up 20, I had Kaiser, and it went up something like 21% this year. And they think, well, it was because of the healthcare bill, because that's what Republicans are telling me. And it makes logical sense. It's not factually true, but there's a logic to it. And foreclosures continue to be up. The economy isn't going down. When you had Obama basically saying that 9% unemployment was unacceptable, and now they shrugged their shoulders at 9.5% unemployment, and it'll get better eventually. People are thinking, well, maybe Republicans are right. They couldn't make our lives better.
So what do you... I mean, to go back, and I don't mean to harp on this point, but I'm going to, because I think it's a very important one. You know, Rush Limbaugh has 20 million listeners a day because he has a message that is somehow resonating with a large number of people. Right?
Yeah,
I mean, so if you read the book, right, your takeaway is that the people in this category of American Taliban are basically, you know, unthinking, you know, dim-witted, cynical, you know, kind of nasty people who, you know, don't care about the truth, don't care about, you know, anything other than, you know, their own values, and they're just really a pretty, you know, unpleasant bunch that...
Which
you know,
would be fine if they kept them to themselves.
Right, but we're talking about, you know, we're talking about a large number of people, and they are clearly responding to something that is real in their world.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
So you know, it's not simply a creation of some autonomous, you know, media machine or something. I mean, there are real values at issue there. I mean, there are a lot of people who think that, you know, what's on TV day to day is not appropriate for their children, for example. You know, that's not a irrational, insane feeling to have about it.
Yeah, but it is when they write letters to the FEC or FTC. Oh no, FCC.
FCC. Yeah.
Yeah, when they write letters to the FCC demanding that dance or So You Think You Can Dance be sanctioned because they had a hip hop routine that was sexually suggestive. That's, you know, turn off the TV. Be a responsible parent. Nobody's saying that. I don't let my kids watch Family Guy because it's not appropriate for them, even if it's a cartoon. I am a parent. But ultimately, I mean, the reason they listen to Rush Limbaugh and the reason they watch Fox News is because they're convinced that the world is liberal. And it's a sort of an ideological safe zone for them to go in where they're not going to be told what reality really looks like. You know, as Stephen Colbert said, reality has a well-known liberal bias. And this is probably the wisest thing he ever said. And it's true. Reality has a well-known liberal bias. And so they've created this infrastructure. And it's amazing. You go, Pew did a sort of study of media consumption, and they looked at conservatives. And 80% of conservatives got all their news from either Fox News or talk radio. It was 80%. For liberals, they were all over the map. CNN, NPR, network news. I mean, they got their news from wherever, right? Because there's no need amongst liberals to find a ideological safe haven because reality is progressive. I mean, people don't want to be hateful. They don't want to be intolerant. They do believe in tolerance and equality because those are American values. So they don't need to find a place where those values don't exist or are perverted beyond recognition. And that's what Fox News and Rush Limbaugh do. They make it seem that empathy is a bad thing. That was the whole Sotomayor hearings were about, how terrible empathy is. So they've created a notion where tolerance, empathy. I mean, I have a section in the book on the women chapter about how Rush Limbaugh, you know, laments a chickification of society because female values such as compromise are now valued. How being, you know, empathy, these are terrible things to him. He's offended because he wants a world where aggressive style, you know, tactics and values are celebrated. And so the culture moves away from him. The broader world moves away from him. So they create this ideological bubble as a safe zone, just like in the Islamic world, you have these Islamic fundamentalists create the madrasas and other sort of this religious structure that tries to shut out the real world, the outside world, because it's more comforting to their bigotry to create that.
Now, don't you think that, I mean, your book risks, and Daily Kos to some extent as well, risks a little bit of the same sin in the sense of you know, being a safe zone for people who agree with you, basically.
Nope. I don't believe that.
Well, do you think somebody who didn't agree with you would read this book and then come out of it agreeing with you?
You know, I wouldn't have thought so. I got one email from somebody, but that's not what I did. I mean, the reason I wrote this book is, one, because I've been hearing for 9 years how I want the terrorists to win, and I want to make it very clear where I stood on that. And I think mission accomplished. I've made it very clear where I stand on that. Two, I wanted to make sure that progressives who want to believe that Americans can never be that bad, and so we'll ignore their violent rhetoric, we'll ignore their weapons stashes and their ammunition shortages, we'll ignore those values and those tactics, and we'll pretend that everything's okay. And then in 2-3 years, if things are going downhill and they get more violent, people sit around saying, well, nobody could have predicted. Just like nobody could have predicted that Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Nobody could have predicted that our insufficient stimulus would be insufficient to get our country out of this recession. People are always saying, oh, nobody could have predicted. Well, I'm saying, if we don't pay attention to these people and we don't make sure that they're marginalized and pushed back in the shadows where they belong, out in the outer fringes, that we risk a situation where violence is more accepted. And you have a group of people who are really undermining the legal framework that prevent the worst abuses. I mean, you see it in their screaming about activist judges. Any ruling that has a basis in fairness or justice is decried as being activist judges. You see it in the way they attack constitutional freedoms. I mean, this Ground Zero Mosque, which is actually a Burlington coat factory 2 blocks away from Ground Zero that wants to be converted into a community Muslim community center. The notion that these people don't have a right, even though the First Amendment allows it, very un-American, but this is what they're trying to do, undermine our First Amendment freedom of religion. They're trying to undermine anything having to do with habeas corpus. They're pushing forth the notion that torture is okay and justified, that kind of violence that used to shock us to the core is now no big deal.
So who is the book for? I mean, what is the purpose of the book? Beyond, so you said to kind of make it clear that you don't want the Taliban to win.
The book is a clarion call of what we face, what kind of enemy we face, and that we can't sugarcoat it and pretend that this is a disagreement about taxes and whether millionaires should get them or just those under $250,000. That there's a broader movement that's taking over the Republican Party, that's marginalizing sort of the relatively sane voices in that party, and I mean relatively in the most generous way, because selfish, and but I'll take selfish over violent, extremist, ideologically rigid any day of the week.
So the debate about tax cuts is part of all of this, or not?
I mean, no. And the book is very clear. I mean, it's focused on social issues, and the violent fringe. Now, you can say, is George Bush Jr. a member of the American Taliban? Well, he enabled a lot of the worst excesses. I mean, I don't think he actually cares about gay people. Maybe he does. I never saw any kind of passion in that. But he also got the country into two ideologically motivated wars. One of them probably justified initially, the other one absolutely not, because their violent fringe was demanding essentially what has amounted to a holy war. I mean, when you have the Pentagon releasing briefing reports on the progress in the war in Iraq with Bible verses on the front page, you realize that there is a religious component to it that is beyond any notion of national defense to ideology, and they dragged us into that. And Bush obviously enabled it. He enabled Cheney or whoever else really wanted the war. I don't know if Bush really wanted it, but he made it happen. And so he enabled a lot of those worst abuses. So, there's, you know, of course, you have people who really believe this stuff, and you have those who let it happen, even if they themselves only let it happen because it's politically expedient. Mm-hmm.
So to shift ground a little bit, I was interested in some of your thoughts about the current election cycle, and we've talked a little bit about that. And to start that off, I want to ask you what you thought Obama's, you know, kind of mistakes have been, or you know, good things that he's done have been, and how do you see that kind of playing out in the current election cycle?
Yeah, the biggest mistake I think Obama did is. And not just Obama, but I think Harry Reid was a factor. I mean, the biggest problem we have in this political system is the filibuster in the Senate. I mean, the 60-vote rule has made it impossible to govern. But you never heard Bill Frist, when he was majority leader, complain about 60 votes. Never. Never heard about 60 votes. He came in, he said, we've got the majority, we're going to push this vote, and if you vote against it, we're going to run against it. We're going to use that vote against you in the next election. And he came in it from a position of strength and confidence. You have Harry Reid, first day, he's got 59 seats because there's a disputed election in Minnesota, and he says, I can't do anything, I need 60. Day one, he's telegraphing, he's delivering a handwritten letter to the Republicans saying, I'm not going to make you pay for obstructing. Worst day Harry Reid, I think, ever had was when Al Franken was seated and suddenly had 60 votes because he's like, oh, crap, now I got to maybe govern. And I think he was so relieved when Scott Brown won in Massachusetts because suddenly he had that 60-vote excuse again. But then you had Obama, who was more concerned about bipartisanship for the sake of bipartisanship than in passing the best possible legislation for the country. So he enabled, Max Baucus, negotiate with Mike Enzi on healthcare. Mike Enzi is one of the most conservative senators from the most conservative state. They were never going to let anything happen. He was openly bragging at public events about how he was helping obstruct the healthcare bill. Yet Obama and Baucus genuinely sought compromise when it was obvious there was going to be none. They should have come in saying, this is best for the country, this is what we're going to push for. And if suddenly you had to compromise in the heat of the debate, that's a different story, but they compromised from the start. They telegraphed weakness, and they said, we are more interested in getting bipartisanship. And the irony is that most of this legislation that was killed by Republicans, whether it's the public option, even single-payer health care, comprehensive immigration reform, all of this stuff was popular with the voters in bipartisan margins. So Republicans, 40% of Republicans supported the public option. It's not, but they thought, well, Mike Enzi, that's bipartisanship. If we can get Republicans in Congress, instead of saying, look, a bipartisan majority of the American people support this, we're going to push this, and we're going to make you pay it in the next election. So what they did, of course, is they energized Republicans because they were such a fantastic job of halting the Obama Democratic agenda. They have their ideological bubble, so they convinced themselves that Obama wants to bring Hitler back to life in a cloning lab in a government-run lab. And then you have Democrats saying, like, this is why we fought for two cycles to give you supermajorities for? This is what we get? And so we're demoralized.
Well, I think, you know, what Obama was trying to do was to kind of reset the scene a little bit and say, well, we're not just going to have a situation where, you know, one party comes in and, you know, jams their agenda down, and then that doesn't go so well, the next party comes in and jams their agenda down.
How'd that work out?
Well, I don't think we know yet.
It didn't work out.
On what basis do you say that?
On the fact that none of that legislative good stuff passed, on the basis that Democrats are about to get crushed in November, and on the basis that Obama's popularity is tanked, and on the basis that we have a right wing that clearly is gleeful at how they've been able to damage Obama and are not interested in any sort of effort to rehabilitate that image or to make Obama's next 2 years any more successful.
Well, there is a different, you know, way of interpreting that, which is that he did pass the stimulus bill, he did pass a health care bill. There have been certain things that have gotten done. We're in a terrible economic cycle, which is damaging to any incumbent, no matter what the context. So, you know, you could say, well, you know, the economy's, you know, in a bad spot, and so that's going to hurt the incumbents. It doesn't really require a bigger theory of, you know, how they blew it.
Yeah, I used to buy the incumbent stuff, and I used to push it myself. The latest numbers, the data just doesn't support that anymore. I mean, you have Charlie Cooks has the 80 most competitive House races, and there's three Republicans in that entire list, three. And those are three open seats. Well, two open seats and then actually four. Two open seats. Louisiana seat that was picked up on a fluke because William Jefferson was a crook who was busted by the FBI with $80,000 in a freezer. And the other one was the Hawaii special election, which was a three-way race. So Democrats split their vote amongst two candidates. So it's not really an anti-incumbent election anymore. It is basically a referendum on Obama, and it's going very poorly. And I got to say, though, that the last couple of weeks, Democrat numbers have been trending up slowly, and it's because finally, now that people realize that Republicans may actually win, people are shifting from punish Democrats for being ineffective to, okay, who do I really want in power? And that's actually boding well for Democrats, because as unpopular as Democrats are, the polling also very clearly shows that Republicans are even more unpopular. But
I think on that point, you know, I think the conventional wisdom that, you know, there's going to be a giant Republican sweep, and, you know, I don't actually see that. I mean, here in California, for example, you know, you've got, you know, Meg Whitman pouring, you know, $120 million into this race, and she can't even break into a lead over arguably a very weak Democratic
candidate.
Yeah,
but that's because every one of her ads is just so obnoxious and people are so sick of them that it's more of a function of, like, you spent a little bit too much. The governor's race.
Well, I don't
race
know. Carly Fiorina's Senate race, same thing.
The governor's
you know,
race
the,
is...
The attorney general's race, you know, because... The governor's Democrats race is, have a terrible yeah. candidate, you know, but I mean...
No, the governor's race is better because, I mean, if Jerry Brown actually woke up from his nap and campaigned, I mean, we might actually see something brewing. But California and Washington are sort of the exception to the rule. I mean, literally, those are the two states that we're not seeing. And we actually have a Republican in California that is, you know, potentially threatened in the House. So California and Washington are different. But look at the Midwest, and it's death out there for Democrats. And that's the areas that are most economically devastated in this economy. So, I mean, California's a kind of a bright spot. And it wasn't always so. I mean, it's still a tight race here. I mean, nobody here in California should think that we've got this in the bag, because it's still extremely competitive.
Right.
And it shouldn't be, given our demographics.
So I wanted to, before we get to the end of my questioning, wanted to ask you a few other things just about yourself and about your own career and your businesses and so forth. And so I'm interested to know kind of what is your main focus currently, personally, and how do you view your kind of blog business? I mean, I've never been sure to what extent Daily Kos is kind of a business versus a passion. And then you do have SB Nation, the sports blog network, which is clearly a business with VC funding and all that. So could you talk a little bit about just kind of your own personal entrepreneurial efforts?
Yeah, SB Nation is sort of an offshoot of Daily Kos, because I was early on in my career, I realized that the blogging was really good when you had my team versus their team, sort of team-centric approach to whatever the issue is, and blogging is fantastic. And I thought, okay, where do you have teams of that sort? And you have them in politics, obviously, Democrats versus Republicans. You have them in sports, clearly. I mean, right now, I should be watching the Bears-Packers game on Monday Night Football, but I was already committed to this. Religion. And I thought, well, religion people kill each other, so maybe I'll stay away from that one. So sports it was, and that's where I expanded. And it has been funded by Accel and Comcast Ventures. So it's, and actually, we just closed a series, not closed, we have a term of understanding with a new VC for a third round of funding, an eight-figure round of funding. So that company is going fantastic. But at this point, my involvement in it is a board seat and pretty much low single digits in equity, because you get diluted and diluted and diluted. So I love it because I love sports. It's my other passion. But Daily Kos is always, it's my baby. I mean, it's where I focus 95% of my energies. And it's interesting because I'm right now, we're in the process of raising capital for an expansion of Daily Kos. And it's a lot of hard. Sports blogs is very easy to see an exit, right? How are the investors going to make money? And it's easy exit. With Daily Kos, I'm saying, I'm not going to sell it. So, yeah. Don't
yeah,
invest.
So how do you raise money for
it's,
that?
It's not a good investment. Don't invest because I'm not going to sell it.
So how do you raise money?
A lot. You're looking for people that are passionate about the mission of Daily Kos. And there are always spin-off opportunities like Sports Blogs, which was a spin-off of Daily Kos. So there are always things that could come out of it. But if you're looking for the big payoff with Daily Kos, I'm just not going to offer it because I don't see Daily Kos as a business as I see it, as much as I see it as a passion. And I see it as an integral part of the progressive movement. You know, when we're talking about how Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Fox News reach such a huge percentage of the conservative base, and we're a couple blogs and Daily Kos and Keith Olbermann, I actually take my role very seriously in that ecosystem, and I want to do what I can to grow it and to expand on that, because we actually don't have much, and nobody else has really filled the void. I thought Arianna Huffington would with the Huffington Post, but they're, you know, they're doing a lot of good work, but they're also focused heavily on celebrity news and other areas of other topics that bring a lot of eyeballs in. I mean, that's a powerhouse of powerhouses. I mean, it's amazing what Arianna has done, and I wish I had a fraction of her energy. But it's a little more diffuse than what I want. I want something very focused and tailored on expanding and growing the progressive movement.
So we're going to go to questions in just a couple minutes, so get your questions ready, and there'll be a mic, and I'll just ask one or two more things here. So is currently, how many employees does Daily Kos have?
Daily Kos is up to 9 to 10 employees, and then 3 to 5 contractors, depending on the day of the week.
And what kind of expansion do you envision?
I'd love to have a stronger presence in Washington. I'd love to be able to pay more of my writers. I think we have some of the best policy writers. I mean, which is kind of odd for me and strange because Daily Kos was created as an election focus site, and my passion is still elections. But we were very, very solid on the policy front last year on the healthcare debate and on the financial services. On the financial reform law. So I'd like to be able to expand on that further, solidify the platform, modernize, be more professional. I mean, right now it's still a shoestring operation. And I look at what we've done with sports blogs and how nice it's been as a professionalized company, and I'm getting a little jealous, and I want a little bit of that on Daily Kos.
So how do you marry a more professionalized kind of operation with something that's very much been driven by a kind of ideological passion?
Believe it or not, a human resources person actually goes a long way towards making that happen.
Well, there is, though, still, you know, you kind of have this tension because Daily Kos really speaks to the fellow travelers, as it were. I mean, that's
not the best choice of words, yeah.
but it's very much a kind of community of people who are relatively like-minded and kind of sharing a lot of information around a certain thing. And as you try to get a bigger audience, you have to be kind of less like that in a way.
That's a theory. I mean, there's a huge potential audience out there that doesn't know Daily Kos exists, or other sites like it, that the sort of online progressive world doesn't exist. I'm not an absolutist about Daily Kos on the online world. I recognize we do certain things well. Other allies in the online world do certain things well, too. So I'm not trying to be the king of the blogosphere. I just think that we have a nice niche, and we can grow that niche and the potential audiences out there. But we can also provide a better experience for our readers. And our technology was fresh and cutting edge 5 years ago, in internet years. And, you know, I'm about 87 years old now, and it's kind of painful, and I need a hip replacement.
I've been there. Yeah.
So we gotta keep up with the times, and that requires resources that we haven't been able to do running the site on a shoestring budget.
Okay, so do we have some questions? The mic is just to your left there.
Marcos, two polls earlier this month, CNN and Fox. I know you're familiar with the CNN poll because I heard you answered me on Ron Owens' show on KGO. But Fox, show a majority of Americans are against the war in Iraq and hope it will end, but think it was the right thing to do, quote unquote, a good idea that has made the U.S. and the world safer. A war which has left the Iraqis better off, and which our efforts to bring stability and order to Iraq are going well or very well. And I wonder if you've taken a look at that poll that you said you were interested in. It was Fox. I aired in saying Quinnipiac or Pew. Have you had a chance to look at that Fox News poll that says 58% of Americans think it was the right thing to do to go into Iraq?
Yeah, Fox News also thinks that Obama's a Kenyan socialist. So show me real polling. Legitimate polling. But ultimately, people are still against the war in Iraq. They think it was a mistake if they had to do it all over again. Polling, it's overwhelming. The polling is overwhelming. There's just no way around that. And a single Fox News poll does not negate the fact that every other legitimate pollster out there has shown the exact same thing. If I had an internet connection right now, I would whip it up, and I in 3 seconds, I could show you. Pollingreport.com. They have all the polls on the Iraq war, and you could see it, and it's not even close. It's not even close.
So the company Opinion Dynamics is completely bogus as a polling company?
I'm telling you, it's the overwhelming amount of polling. I can sit there and find one poll that shows me whatever I want, but when you look at the aggregate polling, it's not even close. The American people are still opposed to the war in Iraq, and no amount of wishing otherwise is going to change the fact that we lost 4,000 or 5,000 people in Iraq for absolutely zero reason other than George Bush's ego and the neocons' fantasies, and we're making the same mistake in Afghanistan right now, and the American people, again, won us out of Afghanistan for the exact same reasons.
Are you aware that there are liberal Muslims that oppose the mosque in New York, including Zudi Jasser, a leader for Democratic Islam?
The First Amendment is not negotiable. Not negotiable.
Thank you, sir. We'll go on to the next question. Thanks.
Around 2005, Mikey Weinstein, who was a Republican attorney who served in the Reagan White House in the West Wing, filed a lawsuit because the Air Force Academy was taken over by a Christian fundamentalist sect that was trying to force all of the people, including Jewish cadets, into going to Christian activities. And I'm wondering if you haven't missed out on an opportunity to reach out to those people who believe in a small, limited government but a strong military, because I think they're also very concerned about a Christian fundamentalist takeover of our nation.
I mean, there's a libertarian component, of course, and the size of that libertarian demographic is debatable. But right now they've thrown their lot in because they want the tax cuts for the rich to happen, so they've thrown their lot in with the Tea Party crowd. I don't see them that concerned about social issues right now. Ideally, these people would be potential allies, but they weren't there. They were certainly not there when Bush was increasing the surveillance state and the unitary executive, and they are not there now when Obama's doing the same thing, which I certainly oppose. And all they care about is tax cuts. That's it. That's their singular purpose.
I really have two questions. One, wondering if you've seen, it was all over the news today, Alan Grayson's ad calling his opponent the American Taliban.
I did see that. That was pretty exciting.
Yes. The second is I was wondering how you equate what's happening today with the Tea Party movement to the rise of the new right, the Phyllis Schlafly's, that whole previous movement that has seemed to just, well, maybe not disappear, morphed into this.
Yeah, it's more morphed. I mean, back to Alan Grayson, it's actually a very interesting case study because here's a first-term congressman. He's a freshman who is one of the prime targets for the Republicans. He's in a district that's slightly Republican. So it leans Republican, not very much, but it does lean Republican, in a year where even districts that are heavily Democratic are competitive. So you have Alan Grayson in this district being very, very aggressive, basically running the kind of campaign that people like me have argued you should run. He's definitely steady in the polls. His own polling has him up. The other side isn't releasing any polling, which is always suspicious, because if they had good numbers, they would release it. And so it seems like it's working. And this is going to be a very important race to watch, because if he survives in that kind of district with that kind of politics, this aggressive, full-throated progressivism, using the kind of rhetoric that makes DC types like faint, you know, they need a fainting couch because somebody calls somebody a Taliban and it's the worst thing in the world. If he wins that district in a year that he shouldn't, by any stretch of the imagination, then I think it's going to send a message that maybe, just maybe, being progressive sells even in tough Republican-leaning districts. And as far as the old movement, I mean, it's all a continuation. That started in 1964 when Barry Goldwater was booted. Instead of slinking off to the shadows, these people realized they were in a deep minority. It's conservatives, and they started building. It took them 16 years to win the White House. It took them 30 years to win back Congress. And they won the White House with Ronald Reagan, who wouldn't survive 2 seconds in today's GOP because he was pro-amnesty. He raised taxes. He negotiated with terrorists, Gorbachev. He was the evil empire. And he opposed an anti-gay initiative here in California. So he would not last 2 seconds in today's Republican Party. No matter how much they pretend to worship him, he wouldn't last 2 seconds. And now this is sort of the culmination. It's finally the people who were busy being the foot soldiers but were being led around by the Karl Robes have risen up, essentially, and taken out establishment Republican after establishment Republican in scores of primaries around the country. And the reason that Democrats are still in the game, and they're still in the game, is because they've given us some fantastically out of touch candidates to run against. But ultimately, this election is going to be the difference. We're going to lose a lot of seats. The difference is going to be, do we lose 25 blue dogs, which would make it a really fantastic night for us? Or are there collateral damage like Russ Feingold and Alan Grayson and Barbara Boxer? I mean, that's going to be what's going to determine whether we win or lose this. And they're a competitor because they've been able to build this machine, and they're flexing their muscles, and they're bringing a lot of energy to the Republican Party this year, even though there's a ton of tension between the establishment and the Tea Party crowd. They brought a lot of energy, and it's that energy that's created the enthusiasm gap, which means that they're more motivated to vote than our side is, and that's why they're in the lead, because they're still not popular with the American people, but they're more eager to vote than our side, and that's what's going to potentially kill us.
Great. I think it's really important to look at everything historically a little bit, and then think, well, what positive, I mean, we had hoped Obama was doing that, what positive message, because the right really rules with fear, playing on ignorance, and it's the ancient, you know, I have a theory that, you know, in human DNA, there's still so much of the ancient warrior, you know, kind of hunters and gatherers, fighting in there, and enough human nature hasn't evolved.
But there's a lot of tribalism, too.
Tribalism, yeah. Yeah. So, on the other hand, I mean, I spent some time in Afghanistan, and I know people that are attached to their local communities, but that doesn't mean they're violent and ignorant people, even if they're illiterate. You know, they still have an evolution going on. But this usage of fear, which Machiavelli used, playing on ignorance, and subordinating women, I mean, they all go together, that liberalism, progressivism, and feminism have all become bad words. So the right so well uses fear, playing on fear and ignorance. What can we need to have a positive message to make people say, yes, this would be fun to read Dellicos, and this would be fun, you know, to vote for liberals and progressives.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the hallmarks of the Netroots and this art movement is we're predicated on a lot of fun. And, I mean, drinking liberally, you know, is wildly successful. And it's people getting together to talk politics over beer. No more church basement or union halls. You know, we're going to actually have fun as we wage politics. But to your broader point, I mean, one of the criticisms I got was, well, the why do you call them the American Taliban? Why do you compare them to the Taliban when there's so many right-wing movements that are similar? There's nothing uniquely you know, about the conservative movement that's unique just to the Taliban. And at the point, I mean, the reason I call it the American Taliban is because they've been comparing, they've been saying, I want the Taliban to win. But if they were saying that I wanted Serbian nationalists to win, it would have been just as applicable, because right-wing, reactionary, hateful, scaremongering movements are a dime a dozen around the world. And it's just not the Middle East, and it's just not in America where we see these. We see them all over. And they are, you're right, they're predicated on fear of the other.
Well, so, just to... to follow up on that a little bit, I mean, is there a but there's a religious component to all of this, right? That's important. That's different from a nationalist component.
Religion always plays, and I think religion provides that moral certainty that the other might not have. And once you believe that you're the word of God, I mean, anything is justified. Any tactic is justified, and any kind of compromise is no longer allowed, because how could you compromise the word of God? You cannot do that.
And that's my follow-up.
So, we have one more question behind you there.
So why do the right-wing Fox and so on have such a large following and we don't?
Because there's enough of them that feel ideologically alienated by reality because it's so liberal, and that's their safe haven. They all watch, 80% of conservatives watch Fox News and listen to Rush Limbaugh. We don't have anywhere near that kind of concentration, because liberals don't feel under siege ideologically, because reality does not offend us, doesn't scare us.
So we have time for one more quick question, I think.
Well, I'm going to make it two, but I'll make them quick questions. One micro, one macro. If you could see a serious debate between one progressive candidate and a conservative candidate, who would that debate be? Not
serious?
Yeah, an actual serious debate between those.
What's the fun?
And then on the macro level, can you talk a little bit about bloggers versus journalists, or are they exactly the same, and what your feelings are about that?
Yeah, I'll speak to that first. The blogger versus journalist divide is really it's blurred to the point where you have journalists blogging and you have bloggers doing journalism. There was never much of a line. I mean, really it was the ages-old establishment versus the outsiders, and that was what that whole, quote, debate was ever about. Is people saying, who the hell is this Marcos, and he, why does he have an audience when I don't, or who cares what he thinks? I don't know him. I don't know what his credentials are. There was a book that came out and trashed me for not even having a journalism degree. I actually have a journalism degree, so I know firsthand how worthless it is.
And I don't have one, by the way. So.
Good. See, you don't need a journalism degree to do good journalism, because journalism is just about chronicling the world around you, and you don't need to go to school to do that. It's ludicrous. So they are, I mean, the divide is gone. I think nobody's really pretending there's much of a debate anymore about that. And then serious debate. Is that even possible these days? I mean, I would love, Mike Castles of the Republican Party were serious people, because they only care about tax cuts for the rich, right? And of course, he's been booted out of his own party. But I would love to see a debate between Howard Dean and Christine O'Donnell. And I know that's not serious, but I'm on a stage sitting in his chair, so I get to take a little poetic license. And because that actually would be entertaining. I mean, I would love to get a look at their worldview, a closer look, and understand how that fits in reality. And because it doesn't. It doesn't fit in, so.
Okay, one quick question. From your perspective, what is the likelihood that the Tea Party activists that do get elected to Congress this cycle will actually be able to take over the Republican Party? I ask this because we've seen something similar time and time again, the last time around 1994.
Yeah, how serious is the Tea Party? I think it's they're close to success. I mean, what's going to happen is one of two things. It's either they're going to be very successful and they're going to win, and then they're going to be able to say it was our energy that won the election, and it will be right. So it's going to be harder for the establishment to push back against that. I mean, they're not happy about this. They're actually suing the Tea Party crowd in Delaware and a couple other states. New Hampshire, I think, is another one. So they're actually starting to sue each other. But if they lose, it's where the things are going to get really interesting, because the Tea Party are going to argue that they lost because they weren't conservative enough, and the establishment is going to argue, well, we lost because you guys are crazy, and people hate crazy. It's not an electoral winner. Like, Christine O'Donnell is anti, like, she had the power, she would force people to stop having sex. That's not an electoral winner. I don't care if you're in Delaware or Alaska, clearly not Alaska, given the Palin family. So that to me is, and that's where I live for that. That's my big dream, because that'll spill over into the presidential race, and nobody's going to be pure enough for the Tea Party crowd. And so things are about to get really interesting, but first they have to lose, and that's sort of my priority right now. If they win this election, I think their chances of taking over the Republican Party become a lot stronger.
Great.
They're supported by big money.
Okay, sorry, we can't, because it's on the radio, we can't take a question not at the mic there. And actually, we are just at the end, and it's a new Inforum tradition that we close by asking our speaker, Mr. Marcos Melitzis, what is your 60-second big idea for changing the world?
60-second, it's two words, vote Democratic. Maybe I can try to pad that by saying, like, really, really, really vote and bring five people to vote with you and really get involved. And you don't have to be excited about the Democrats. And a unenthusiastic vote counts just as much as an enthusiastic vote. The fact is that things are going to go backwards if these new Tea Party crowd take over control of Congress. And as disappointing as the status quo may be, at least they're not moving backwards.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Marcos, and let's give a big round of applause. So this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.